The tape which you are about to hear was made in the University of Dayton Fieldhouse on some Sunday, November the 29th, 1964. The first voice that you will hear is that of Commissioner Crawford, then that of President Charles Wesley of Central State College.
I've come bearing a souvenir presentation, and I refer to it that way because of a calculated choice of language, frankly. You see, I am not particularly pleased with the official stature and posture of the city of Dayton this moment with regard to the usual connotation of keys to the city. You have heard, I'm sure, very sincerely and often tritely as a cliché that they are supposed to, figuratively at least, open all the doors and all the hearts of the city to which they represent. There are people in this hall by the thousands who know that in spite of the fact that you are a great minister of God's people, a world-renowned orator, a disciple and battler for truth and good across the world, one of the world's most renowned men, there still in this city are some doors that neither this key nor my persuasion could open for you. And so my presenting this souvenir to you present a rather untenable situation except for one fortunate thing about our city, the form of our government. We have, as you may or may not know, a commission manager form of government here in which the elected legislative body is composed of five men, one of whom is called the mayor, the other four referred to as commissioners, five men elected and who are under God and under our charter at least equal. Therefore, Dr. King and ladies and gentlemen, I do not come as a substitute or a stand-in for someone else, nor do I come representing presumably the congregate voice of City Hall, but rather I come as the somewhat self-appointed spokesman of the thousands of people such as these who sincerely welcome you to this city. I subscribe to a simple thesis that for every public servant who lives a lie, there are a thousand men who serve their fellow men well, with honesty and care, and for every little group of men who would like to enslave the souls of other men, there are legions now, this day, that will never permit it to happen as long as men like you give leadership to people like this across this land. Around us, there are, as you well know, many good and fine things, and I know that there are literally thousands and thousands and thousands of Daytonians of all kinds of ancestral backgrounds, of all complexions and all spiritual persuasions that are thankful to Almighty God that He saw fit to have you live in this our day, and are grateful that as you make your way across your life's journey in this world, you saw fit to pause in Dayton this night. On their behalf, I present this beautifully crafted, shiny little key, Dr. King, that is the key of the real Dayton.
He needs no introduction to an audience at almost any point in the United States or abroad. We merely present him because nearly every one of us knows something good about Martin Luther King. I present him to you, therefore, as a gifted leader of our time, an eloquent advocate of basic human rights for all, and a voice of a marching people looking toward and reaching for a larger freedom. Nurtured in the tradition of religious leadership, trained in philosophy, religion, and social science, so that he brings brilliant powers of analysis, of synthesis, and precise presentations to the perplexing problems of our day. Educated at Morehouse College, Crozier Theological Seminary, and at Boston University, where he received the highest of the university degrees, the Doctor of Philosophy, a thoughtful statesman, a courageous leader in the moving events of our national and now our international life, in which he has participated with wisdom and resolution as president of the Montgomery Improvement Association and founder and president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. I present to you, ladies and gentlemen, a profound student of the philosophy of nonviolence, two paragraphs or three paragraphs of which you will find on the back sheet of your program, a man who is an exponent of peaceful resistance to aggression, a believer in the doctrine of the soft answer turning away wrath, even when attacked by the representative of the FBI, who gave him a very derogatory and biased statement, and he turned the other cheek. And yet, my friends, despite this, Martin Luther King has courageously engaged in the struggle for the advancement of all the people, in the confident belief that the battle is not for the strong, but to those with minds and hearts resolute in their desire and purpose to join the ranks of the free, who have learned to appreciate and accept the responsibility for the extension of basic human rights through themselves to all of the nation and all of the world. Universities and colleges have honored him. We honored him at Central State College in 1958. We honored him then. We are here to honor him now as a trusted leader of peoples in all parts of the free world. And we do not use it as some people use the word free world in our day. We use it with the prophecy and the hope of the future, where the world in reality shall be free. Of that free world, of those people who seek to free themselves from both the old and the new colonialism, the old and the new imperialism, the enforced segregation based either upon color or upon the amount that one has to pay. And we would assume that all of us desire to join with Martin Luther in the hope and determination that all men and women, black and white, shall be free in law and free in fact, and shall brothers be in one community. This is our dream, and it is his dream, and he's talked about it. You remember in Washington, I have a dream. Our dream. You, Martin Luther King, are our
presiding officer, my dear friend, Dr. George Lucas, to all of the distinguished platform guests, ladies and gentlemen of the city of Dayton, I need not pause to say how very delighted and honored I am to have the opportunity to come to this community and to see and greet you tonight. I want to pay my deep personal appreciation to my good friend George Lucas, to all of the other ministers of the gospel and all of the sponsoring organizations that made this meeting possible. I look forward to being with you with great and eager anticipation, and I can assure you that it is a real pleasure. I'm also deeply indebted to my dear friend, Dr. Charles Wesley, for these kind and gracious words of introduction. And I'm so happy to be an honorary alumnus of the institution that he has led in such a brilliant and great manner across the years. I must apologize to each of you for being late tonight. I had to speak in Cincinnati earlier today, and the Reverend Dr. Booth drove us over, and as we started out, we noticed that a little snow was falling, and it continued to fall, and every now and then that car would kind of geared and turn a bit, and I said, now, Ventura, you slow up a little. Tonight I would rather be Martin Luther King late than the late Martin Luther King. In the area of race relations.
that question in my remarks. And I want to try to answer that question in what I consider a realistic manner, avoiding the extremes of both an undue optimism and an undue pessimism. On the one hand, I must affirm that we have come a long, long way in the struggle to make civil rights a reality for all of God's children. But on the other hand, I must say that we still have a long, long way to go before the problem is solved. And it is this realistic position that I would like to use as a basis for our thinking together tonight. We've come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go. Now let me point out first that the Negro himself has come a long, long way in re-evaluating his own intrinsic worth. Now, in order to illustrate this, a little history is necessary. You will remember that it was in the year 1619 that the first Negro slaves landed on the shores of this nation. They were brought here from the soils of Africa. Unlike the Pilgrim Fathers who landed at Plymouth a year later, they were brought here to gain their wills. Throughout slavery, the Negro was treated in a very inhuman fashion. He was a thing to be used, not a person to be respected. The famous Dred Scott decision of 1857 well illustrated the status of a Negro during slavery, for in this decision, the Supreme Court of our nation said in substance that the Negro is not a citizen of the United States. He is merely property, subject to the dictates of his own. It went on to say that the Negro has no rights, that the white man is bound to respect. This was the attitude that prevailed. And as slavery grew, it became necessary to give some justification for it. It seems to be a fact of life that human beings cannot continue to do wrong without eventually reaching out for some thin rationalization to clothe an obvious wrong in the beautiful garments of righteousness. And this is exactly what happened during the days of slavery. Even the Bible and religion were misused in order to crystallize the patterns of the status quo. And so it was argued that the Negro was inferior by nature because of Noah's curse upon the children of Ham. Then the Apostle Paul's dictum became a watchword, "Servants, be obedient to your master." Then one brother had probably read the logic of the great philosopher Aristotle. Aristotle was a great philosopher who lived during the heyday of Greek culture. And he did a great deal to bring into being what we now know in philosophy as formal logic. And in formal logic, there's a big word called the syllogism. Now, the syllogism has a major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion. And so this brother decided to put his argument of the inferiority of the Negro in the framework of an Aristotelian syllogism. He could say, all men are made in the image of God. That was his major premise. Then came his minor premise. God, as everybody knows, is not a Negro. Therefore, the Negro is not a man. This was the kind of reasoning that prevailed. Well, living with the conditions of slavery and then later segregation, many Negroes lost faith in themselves. Many came to feel that perhaps they were less than human, that perhaps they were inferior. the great tragedy of slavery, the great tragedy of segregation. Not merely what it does to one physically, but what it does to the soul, what it does to one psychologically. It ends up giving the segregator a false sense of superiority while leaving the segregated with a false sense of inferiority. This is the tragedy of it. It scars the soul. It does something to one psychologically. And so living with the system of slavery and segregation, many Negroes did end up haunting and nagging feelings of inferiority. But then something happened to the Negro. Circumstances made it possible and necessary for him to travel more. The coming of the automobile, the upheavals of two world wars, the Great Depression. And so his rural plantation background gradually gave way to urban industrial life. And even his cultural life was gradually rising through the steady decline of crippling illiteracy. All of these forces conjoined to cause the Negro to take a new look at himself. Negro masses all over began to reevaluate themselves, and the Negro came to feel that he was somebody. His religion revealed to him that God loved all of his children and that all men are made in his image. Somehow he came to see that every man, figuratively speaking, from a base black to a treble white, is significant on God's keyboard. So he could now unconsciously cry out to the eloquent poet, "Fleecy locks and black complexion cannot forfeit nature's strength. Skin may differ, but affection in black and white the same. Were I so tall as to reach the pole, or to grasp the ocean at a span, I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man." With this new sense of dignity and this new sense of self-respect, a new Negro came into being with a new determination to struggle, to suffer, to sacrifice, and even die if necessary in order to become. So we've come a long, long way since 1619. But not only has the Negro come a long, long way in reevaluating his own intrinsic worth, we are true to the facts. We must admit that the whole nation has come a long, long way in extending the frontiers of civil rights. 50 years ago, even 25 years ago, a year hardly passed when numerous Negroes were not brutally lynched by vicious mobs all across the South. By and large, lynchings have about ceased today. This reveals that we made some strides. At the turn of the century, there were very few Negroes registered to vote in the South. By 1948, that number had leaped 750,000. When we started out for the election in 1960, the number had leaped to 1,200,000. And then, when we went into the election just a few days ago, the number had passed 2 million, which means that we added more than 800,000 new Negro registered voters in the South since 1960. Far from what it ought to be, but it reveals that we've made some strides in areas. In the area of economic justice, we've seen some growth. The average Negro wage earner who is employed today earns 12 times more than the average Negro wage earner of 10 years ago. The national income of the Negro is now better than 28 $1 billion a year, which is more than all of the exports of the United States and the national budget of Canada. This reveals that we've come a long, long way. Probably more than anything else in our day and in our age. We've seen the system of racial segregation crumble. We all know the legal history of racial segregation in our country had its legal beginning in 1896 when the Supreme Court rendered a decision known as the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, which established the doctrine of separate but equal as the law of the land. Now we all know what happened as a result of that old Plessy doctrine. There was always the strict enforcement of the separate without the slightest intention to abide by the equal. So the Negro ended up being plunged into the abyss of exploitation, where he experienced the bleakness of night and injustice. And then after many years of legal segregation, that magnificent day came. And the Supreme Court of our nation in 1954 examined the legal body of segregation and pronounced it constitutionally dead. Said in substance that the old Plessy doctrine must go, that separate facilities are inherently unequal, and that to segregate a child on the basis of his race is to deny that child equal protection of the law. We've seen many changes since that day on May 17, 1954. But along with that, we've seen something else that happened just this year. We've seen the passage by the Congress of our United States, the most comprehensive, the strongest civil rights bill that we've ever had. And I'm happy to report that by and large, communities all across the South, even some communities in the state of Mississippi, are complying with the civil rights bill, particularly the So I'm convinced, my friends, that we've come a long, long way, to put it figuratively in biblical language. We've broken loose from the Egypt of slavery, and we have moved through the wilderness of legal segregation, and now we stand on the border of the promised land of integration. And I am absolutely convinced that the system of segregation is on its deathbed today, and the only thing uncertain about it is how costly the segregationists will make the funeral. The old law. Now this would be a wonderful place for me to end my talk tonight. First, it would mean making a relatively short speech. And this would be a magnificent accomplishment for a Baptist preacher. Second, it would mean that the problem is about solved now. And it would be a marvelous thing if speakers all over the nation could talk about this problem in terms of a problem that once existed, but that no longer has existence. But you see, if I stop at this point, I would merely be stating a fact and not telling the truth. You see, a fact is merely the absence of contradiction, but truth is the presence of coherence. Truth is the relatedness of facts. Now, it is a fact that we've come a long, long way, but it isn't the whole truth. You've got to get the other side. Of a dangerous optimism. If I stop now, I'm afraid that I may send you home with an illusion wrapped in superficiality. So in order to tell the truth, it is necessary to move on and say to you, not only have we come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go. just look around the community, you would have to agree with me that we still have a long, long way to go. I mentioned the fact that lynchings have about ceased, and they have. We must not overlook the fact that there are still tragic moments of violence and terror taking place in communities in the South. We must never forget the fact Medgar Evers was shot down in Jackson, Mississippi, simply because he wanted to see his people free. We must never forget that Sunday morning in Birmingham, Alabama, four beautiful, innocent, unoffending girls were killed in the Church of God. We must never forget the voice of little Emmett C. Till crying from the mad waters of Mississippi. We must never forget that just this summer, three civil rights workers were brutally murdered near Philadelphia, Mississippi. All of this reveals to us that we still have a long, long way to go. Since last May, more than 40 churches, Negro churches, have been burned down in the state of Mississippi. They have a new motto down there now: not attend the church of your choice, but burn the church of your choice. This is tragic. Means that we have a long, long way to go before the brotherhood of man is a reality in our country. I mentioned the strides that have been made in voter registration. Let me give you the other side. I mentioned that we have about 2 million Negroes registered to vote in the South. Remember, there are still more than 10 million Negroes living in the South. Few more than 6 million, these 10 million, are of voting age. And yet only 2,000 are registered. 2 million are registered. Many of these other 4 million are not registered. Not because of apathy, not because they don't want to register. Because all types of conniving methods are still being used in some states in the South keep the Negro from becoming a registered voter. They ask some hard questions at a PhD in any field. A person with a law degree from the best law schools of the country couldn't answer to the even more difficult question of how many bubbles do you find in a bar of soap? And they tell me they ask questions like that in some places in Mississippi. In fact, a man went to register in a place in Mississippi not long ago, and one of the questions was, how many windows are in the courthouse? But I don't know how many windows are in my own house. How many windows in the courthouse? This is a bit humorous, but beneath this humor, something tragic, something shame. In 1964 AD, there are counties in our country where Negroes cannot register without fear of economic reprisals, without fear of death, without facing all types of conniving methods to keep them from registering. And so we have a long, long way to go in America before this problem is solved. I mentioned economic justice, and I mentioned big figure, $28 billion. That's a lot of money. Let us not overlook the other side. No person of goodwill will overlook the other side. That is the fact that 42% of the Negro families of America still earn less than $2,000 a year, while just 16% of the white families earn less than $2,000 a year. 21% of the Negro families of America still earn less than $1,000 a year, while just 5% of the white families earn less than $1,000 a year. 88% of the Negro families of America earn less than $5,000 a year, while just 58% of the white families earn less than $5,000 a year. This is a tragic gulf that must be bridged. America is to be a great nation. The problem is getting even more difficult today. For years we have been denied educational opportunities on a broad and equal level. For years we have been the victims of discrimination all over the South in overt forms and all over the North in covert forms. We've been denied apprenticeship training. And for all of these reasons, we have been limited by and large to unskilled and semi-skilled labor. Now these are the jobs that are passing away because of automation and cybernation. More than 42,000 jobs are being scrapped every week. The Negro, more than anybody else, is on the suffering end. I'm not saying he's the only one, but I'm saying he's on the suffering end a great deal. And if automation is to be a blessing as it can and must be in our society, this problem must be grappled with. There must be massive retraining programs. There must be massive public works programs. There must be massive goodwill in order to get rid that hard core of poverty which we still find all over our nation. 40 million people find themselves in that category. And that is a basic demand now that we grapple with this problem. Now, you know, we hear so many arguments of why we should have integration on the part of those who want to hold on to segregation. And they say a lot of bad things about us. They say a lot of naughty things about us. They say that if the schools and other areas are integrated, this will pull the white race back a generation because of the cultural lag in the Negro community. And they go on to say, you know, the Negro is a criminal. Has a high crime rate in cities all over the country. Individuals who set forth these arguments never go on to say. There are lagging standards in the Negro community, and there certainly are. They lag because of segregation and discrimination. Criminal responses are environmental and not racial. As long as you have people walking the streets, day in and day out, not being able to find jobs. As long as you have people looking down life and seeing it as a long corridor with no exit sign. As long as you find people in our society who are constantly seeing themselves on the lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. That is danger around for the whole society. There is nothing more tragic than to build up a society with a large segment of people in that society who feel that they have no stake in that society. And economic deprivation, social isolation, poverty and ignorance breed crime, whatever the racial group may be. And it is a torturous logic to use the tragic results of segregation as an argument for the continuation of it. It is necessary to get rid of the causal source, and this is the great challenge facing the nation. Now I mentioned that we've come a long, long way in getting rid of segregation. But I want to give you the other side, and that is segregation is still with us. Now, it may be true, as I just said, figuratively speaking, that old man segregation is on his deathbed. But history has proven that social systems have a great last-minute breathing power. And the guardians of the status quo are always on hand with their oxygen tents to keep the old order alive. So segregation is still with us. Today it is with us in a more complicated and more difficult manner. It's growing up in every city of our nation in a de facto sense. much more difficult than the de jure and legal segregation that we've had across the years in the South. Where do we see it? We see it in housing. I imagine you have a little of that problem here today.
Plenty of it. Plenty of it.
Residential segregation, develop de facto segregation in the public schools and in the whole area of life. And so we find ourselves in this period when a new form of segregation is coming into being, which at points is much more difficult to grapple with because it is subtle, because it is not legal, because it is not open. So it means that we have a long, long way to go all over this country. Segregation is still with us. And I say to you tonight, my friends, because I believe that if democracy is to live, segregation must die. beyond the wheels of inevitability. It comes from the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God, and without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. And so we must help time, and we must realize that the time is always right to do right. Now the other men that gets around, he heard a great deal during this recent campaign. Because apparently Mr. Goldwater sincerely believed this myth. And those who supported him. It's the idea that legislation can't solve the problems which we face in human relations. You've got to change the heart, and you can't change the heart through legislation. Now, we heard this so much. We heard it day in and day out. Now, I'm willing to concede a little bit here. I would say that the people who set forth this argument are at least uttering a half-truth. Because if we're going to get this problem solved in the United States, something must happen on the inside, and hearts must be changed. I would be the first to say that. If we're going to solve this problem, every white person in this country must come to see that he must deal justly and rightly with the Negro, not merely because the law says it, but because it's right, because the Negro is his brother. I recognize that. Men must not only be obedient to that which can be enforced by the law, but they must rise to the majestic heights of being obedient to the unenforceable. I recognize this, but now after saying all of this, let me give you the other side. Now, it may be true that morality cannot be legislated, but behavior can be regulated. It may be true that you can't legislate integration, but you can legislate desegregation. It may be true that the law can't change the heart, but it can restrain the heartless. It may be true. It really may be true that the law can't make a man love me, but it can restrain him from lynching me, and I think that's what law. I believe it is a powerful way to grapple with this problem. It has a way of disarming the opponent. It exposes his moral defenses. It weakens his morale, and at the same time, it works on his conscience, and he just doesn't know how to deal with it. I remember down in Birmingham, Alabama, last year when we were in the height of that struggle. And you remember, I'm sure, when Bull Connor had his police dogs and he had all of his fire hoses and all of the brutal methods that you could think of. And I can remember the days and the hours when Mr. Connor was very happy. Whenever some of the spectators who had gone through the discipline of nonviolence in our movement would throw bottles and rocks on the sidelines at the policemen and other things, this cop was always happy. He was happy because he's an expert in violence, and that's all he wanted. He wanted us to turn to violence. And he knew at that moment that he could use all of the force of his brutality in his police force and kill up a lot of innocent Negroes and beat up a lot of people. He knew that. When Brother Connor had to look up morning after morning and see a number that no man could number, marching the streets of Birmingham, Alabama. With humble smiles on their faces, and I would hear him as he said, "Get the dogs," and as he said, "Get the dogs," they would continue to march. That singing ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Then he would tell them, "All right, now go on over there and get the fire hoses." And then as he told them to get the fire hoses, their army continued to march nonviolently, singing, "Over my head, I see freedom in there." You could hear him going on in there singing, "We shall overcome, we shall overcome." And there was something about that Bull Connor couldn't deal with. There was something about it that disarmed Bull Connor. There was a power there. And I heard Bull Connor say that integration would come to Birmingham over his dead body. And I was in that same Birmingham, Alabama, just a few days ago, and stayed in the biggest hotel in downtown Birmingham, Alabama. That is power in this method. You know, another thing about it is this, that it gives you a way to struggle for moral ends through moral means. You don't have to live with the old philosophy that the end justifies the means. You somehow have a method of struggle that coheres with the end that you seek. Because somehow you know that the end is pre-existent in the means. The means represent the idea of the making and the ending process. If you use hate field, violence, evil methods to get to the good end of a great society, then you will have destroyed that end in the process. This is the weakness and the ultimate tragedy of communism. Read Lenin as he says, almost any method is justifiable to bring about the end of the classless society. Well, this is where nonviolence would break with communism and any other method that argues that the end justifies the means. In the long run of history, destructive means cannot bring about constructive ends. And this is what the nonviolent discipline says. And the other thing about it, it helps you to stand up amid the most difficult situation because you have an inner commitment to a higher vengeance. And so if they decide not to put you in jail, wonder. Nobody with any sense just loves to be going to jail. But if they put you in jail, you go in that jail and transform it from a dungeon of shame to a haven of freedom and human dignity. Even if they try to kill you, you develop the inner conviction that there's something so dear, something so precious, something so eternally true that they're worth dying for. And if a man has not discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live. Some great principle, some great opportunity to stand up for that which is just and that which is right and that which is true. And yet he refuses to do it because he's afraid that somebody may shoot at him or his home may get bombed. Or he may lose his job or he may get stabbed. And he wants to live a long life. But he may go on and live until he's 80. But he's just as dead at 35. As he would be at 80, and the cessation of breathing in his life is merely the delayed announcement of an earlier death. Nonviolence gives you the power to stand up here and now against the evils of our days. The other thing about it is this, that it helps you develop an inner attitude of love. The perpetrators of an unjust system. Now, this is difficult. But I don't apologize for advocating. And when I talk about love, I'm not talking about emotional wash. It would be nonsense to urge oppressed people to love their violent oppressors in an affectionate sense. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about something much deeper. I'm talking about something that goes deep down within and that causes you to react toward every man with understanding and goodwill. I mention a great deal because people ask this question about what do you mean when you talk about love, your oppressors, and I always mention the fact that Greek literature comes to our aid in this and the Greek language comes to our aid. In this, there are three words in Greek for love. I want to talk with you about them just a minute. There's one word called eros. Now, that's a beautiful kind of love. Back in the days when a great philosopher like Plato wrote his dialogues, he talked about eros. It's a sort of aesthetic love, a yearning of the soul for the realm of the divine. This has come to us to be a sort of romantic love. So in this sense, we've all experienced eros, and we've read about it in all the beauties of literature. In a sense, Abraham Poe was talking about eros when he talked about his beautiful Annabel Lee surrounded by the halo of eternity with a love that great. In a sense, Shakespeare was talking about eros when he talked about love is not love which alters with its alteration, finds a bench with a remover to remove. It is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempest and is never shaken. It is a star for every wandering bark. You know, I can remember that because I have to quote it to my wife every now and then. Now, the Greek language talks about phileo. That's another word, and it's a very significant level of love. This is friendship, really. On this level, you love people that you like. You love because you are loved. Then the Greek language comes out with another word and calls it agape. Agape is more than eros. Agape is more than friendship. Agape is more than romantic or aesthetic love. Agape is understanding, creative, redemptive goodwill for all men. It is an overflowing love that seeks nothing in return. Theologians would say that it is the love of God operating in the human heart. When one rises to love on this level, he comes to the point of loving the person who does the evil deed while hating the deed that the person does. Now this is what Jesus said. Now this is what Jesus meant when he said, love your enemies, and I'm so happy. He didn't say like your enemies. Like is an affectionate sort of thing. And I must confess that it's pretty difficult to like some people. some senators in Washington that I find it pretty difficult. Brother Thurman, Brother Eastman, and Brother Stennis, it's difficult to like them, but Jesus says, love them, and love is greater than life. Love is understanding, creates the difference of will for all men. This is the time to love. I believe that God will guide us through this period of transition and lead us to a greater day. And this is what we say when we truly become committed to nonviolence. We have a message. It says in substance to the most violent oppressors, we will match your capacity to inflict suffering with our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we will still love you. We cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good, and so throw us in